Science commands great respect in our society, except when it doesn't. We can giggle about previous periods in human history when the idea of the sun as the center of our star system was laughable and true. The giggles reduce when we consider the current moment in which huge numbers of scientists insist the planet is warming because of human use of fossil fuels, and a large chunk of the body politic disagrees. Our guest this hour writes of science and how to think about it. Lee McIntyre wrote The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Lee McIntyre is a philosopher of science, a research fellow at Boston University in the Center for Philosophy and History of Science. He's written two previous books, Dark Ages and Post-Truth. Lee McIntyre, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
So it sounds like this book is part of a trilogy, at least so far.
Not quite a trilogy in the sense that they're all about science denial, but I have been interested in truth for a long time and found myself first defending the idea that the social sciences needed to be more scientific, and then just defending facts and reason in general, and then now moving on to defending science. So it just seems like there's always more work to be done.
Your first sentence in this book speaks of it as a labor of love. So this book is not entirely a reaction to what's going on in terms of science in the world at the moment.
Well, it is in the following sense. I'm a philosopher of science, and I've been thinking about the issue of what's special about science for my entire career. What happened recently is that I realized that this was not just of academic interest. This was a question of defining science so that we could defend it against the people who were attacking it. Philosophers of science have always sort of been interested in this question of what's different about science, what's special about science. But it's a special moment these days, because unless we get this right, I think that we're not going to be able to fight back in the way that we could.
You write in the book about the March for Science held on Earth Day 2017, which you observed in Boston. What brought people out, and what did you see?
Well, there were some there were some really funny signs. I mean, you've got to remember in Boston, there are a lot of educational institutions here, a lot of scientists, and a little bit of a protest culture in general, I guess, just because of so many universities. And so you had people in white lab coats who I'm sure some were scientists and some were not, with funny signs that said things like, "It's so severe, the nerds are here," things like, I've got a couple of other of them in the book, but one of them in particular, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it said something about, you know, "I can't believe that I have to defend facts," or, you know, "I can't believe that I had to come out of my lab to do this." Some other ones said, "I love reality, no science, no Twitter, extremely mad scientist," and one said, "Keep calm and think critically." So, I mean, that was fun.
I love the extremely mad scientist one. That kind of makes a great play on the mad scientist thing. But particularly the signs that referred to, "I had to come out of the lab to do this," do scientists have to be more evangelistic or at least more vocal in this age, do you think?
I think they do, and that's a hard ask, because scientists are very busy. One thing that I noticed, I mean, I'm a philosopher of science. I'm not a scientist, but I'm very pro-science. But one thing that I noticed is that when scientists defend science, they tend to present their evidence. But then what happens if somebody doesn't accept that evidence? What happens if somebody questions them by saying, "Well, come back to me when that's proven," or, you know, "I don't believe what you're saying," or they accuse them of, you know, some sort of malfeasance or greed or something? Sometimes they don't know what to say, and they'll, you know, walk away, or, you know, claim that the person is not worth debating with, which maybe they're not in some sense. But the problem is this: it's growing. And if we don't fight back, what happens is that the science deniers then control the field. Just look at how it's grown in Washington politics. I mean, we're now in an era when quite a number of U.S. senators will at least say that they don't believe in anthropogenic climate change. And I think we've got a president who agrees with them. You know, how did that happen? I don't think that it's scientists' fault that happened. I think that they're doing exactly the kind of work that they were trained to do. But it's really to the point where nobody else can advocate for science in the way that a scientist can. And I think that they can do more to, what I wish is that they would not just talk about their results, but talk about the process, talk about peer review, talk about replication, talk about data sharing, talk about all the rigor that they use to put forward their theories. And if you look at the literature on how to convince people who don't agree with you, what really convinces them is one-on-one conversation. So we absolutely have to engage. We can't just stay in our labs and be right. That just doesn't work.
Lee, before we get to a break in about a minute, who is Karl Popper and why do you feel such reverence for him and his work?
So Karl Popper is one of the most famous philosophers of science ever, and he did his work in 1919, exactly 100 years ago. And he was very concerned with the idea of demarcating between science and non-science. And he thought that he found a logical way to do it, a methodological way, which is kind of the holy grail in philosophy. He was looking for this, you know, this clean break. And he came up with a theory called falsification, which is this idea that scientific theories are not capable of being proven true, but they're capable of being proven false. And he thought that that was it, and I don't think he was right. I think he was on the track of something interesting, but we've now gone on a dogleg for 100 years chasing this down, and I don't think it can be done. I think I have a better answer.
All right, we'll talk about what the scientific attitude in fact is. Lee McIntyre's book is called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. We'll come back and talk more with Lee, and if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Lee McIntyre, who is not a scientist, but a philosopher of science based at Boston University and the Center for Philosophy and History of Science. He is talking about the way in which science has to prove itself in new ways in the world today because a lot of people's political beliefs and religious beliefs interfere with people accepting the science that so many scientists back up. The book is called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Join the conversation on the exchange. Your thoughts, comments, questions, welcome at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Lee, you write about science acknowledging its failures. I mean, it often trumpets its successes. What is gained by talking up its failures?
Well, this goes back to what we were talking about before, where if you're trying to identify what is special about science, you have to figure out, you know, how you're going to deduce that, how you're going to figure that out. One way it has a place in the field is to look at the successes of science, the things that all the great successes through history of physics and astronomy. But one thing that I proposed in my book is that we also need to look at the fields that are trying and failing to become sciences. Because if you think about it, that's where you really learn what the standards are. Not just by measuring the success, but by measuring those fields that are maybe pseudosciences or ideological or even something like the social sciences where they just don't quite have it yet. And that, I think, can be very revealing. It's not something that philosophy of science does very often, but I was inspired by a book by a scientist named Stuart Firestein out of Columbia, who wrote a book called Failure.
Oh, he was here a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's a terrific book, and really, if you think about it, that goes back to Popper that you were asking about a minute ago, because he was talking about how to prove theories wrong. That's a kind of failure, and in science, we learn from failure.
Yeah, it was interesting because he was talking about ignorance, about the fact is that ignorance leads you to wisdom if you let it.
Yeah, he's got one book called Ignorance, one called Failure, and I joked with him when I saw him give a speech once that his next book should be called Catastrophe. I don't know what comes next in the trilogy, but he wrote a terrific book which brings up a very important trope in science, which is that you can't just look at the, you can't just look at the successes. And, you know, if you think about how we were all taught science in school, they presented it as this inevitable victory that, you know, science just led to the day when we knew everything. But they didn't. They never talk about all the false starts, all the mistakes, all the problems along the way. And again, I think that that's one reason why science deniers expect perfection from science. And then when they find out that they can't offer proof or certainty, they think, you know, well, why should I believe you? And it's because they don't understand how science works.
All right, that's what gets to the claim often made of it. Well, it's just a theory, you know. Evolution is just a theory. You know, climate change is just a theory. So let's talk about how to come back at this then. With the title of your book, how does a scientific attitude differ from the scientific method, for example?
Okay, so scientific method. There's nothing wrong with the idea of looking at the fact that scientists observe and they make a hypothesis and they predict and they test the prediction to see if the theory's right. There's nothing wrong with that. Scientists do that every day. But when you say scientific method, it makes me think that folks think that there's some sort of a recipe that can be followed, you know, some inevitable way that if you follow these steps, you're going to find yourself, you're going to discover truth. And like I said, we've tried that for a number of years in the philosophy of science, trying to figure out how to make that work, and it really hasn't worked. I got to thinking about it, and again, this idea does come from Karl Popper, because he talks about something called the critical attitude being important for falsification. Now, he took it in the direction of logic. I take it in the direction of values. I think that what's really distinctive about science is the creed of scientists, the values that they share, the scientific attitude, in short, that the title of the book, what I talk about in the book, is really fairly short. The first thesis is the idea that we care about evidence. And the second is that scientists are open to the idea of using evidence to change their mind. That second part is really important, because if you think about anti-vaxxers, or you think about climate change deniers or flat earthers, what they never do is allow a definitive experiment to overturn their thesis and then move on. They'll find some way to reject a piece of evidence that they don't like. That's not the scientific attitude. Scientists are supposed to respond to evidence. Even if you can't prove a theory true, you can show that it's false. And once you've shown that it's false, we need to move on.
Lee McIntyre, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. So again, the scientific attitude: scientists value evidence and are willing to change their minds when they are presented with new evidence. You got me thinking about how hard it is to perform controlled experiments in things like geology and astronomy. So, I mean, there are cases where the evidence is hard to obtain.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll tell you something, in graduate school and beyond, I spent years breaking my brain on this, because my original academic interest in philosophy of science was arguing that there was no methodological difference between natural and social science. And so you look at the difficulties of performing controlled experiments in psychology, say, or in sociology, but then you bring up the interesting cases in astronomy and geology. They have the same problem. So you know, what is the difference? I ended up in Dark Ages trying to argue that there really wasn't any difference, but then ended up with the idea that what really marks off science is this idea that that evidence counts. Now, how do you find that evidence? It can sometimes be quantitative, sometimes qualitative. Sometimes it comes from observation, sometimes from experiment. Different fields will have different things that they count as evidence. Sometimes it'll be a definitive experiment, sometimes it's statistical evidence. Just the point is that you have to have that critical attitude. You have to be out there looking for some way for your theory to be proven wrong. And an important point, too, is even if the scientist, him or herself, doesn't do that, the profession will. Even if scientists individually want their theory to be true, or, God forbid, they commit fraud, they'll be found out, because the profession embraces this value and has a set of practices in place, you know, like peer review, which will help the profession to find the errors.
So, you know, let's talk about some specific cases in here. You bring up the issue of creation science, that's in quotes, and the idea of teaching both sides of a controversy. And you cite an Arkansas court case against the state law that required the teaching of creation science, but also point out that the pro-science expert witness took heat from scientists for his court appearance. Why?
Well, that was Michael Ruse, who is an eminent philosopher of science. And what happened is, there's this academic debate, as I've said, over what's special about science. And philosophers are not normally called into court to testify. But this was a serious case, because I think that most philosophers of science felt that creation science was not really science, that it was ideology, and it was this attempt to either attack Darwin or to get creationism into the classroom. As you said, teach both sides. So it sounds fair-minded. But what happened in the courtroom is that when pressed, Ruse gave an account of what was special about science that was pretty close to Karl Popper. And as I've said, that his view, although super important for the last 100 years in the philosophy of science, is somewhat controversial and debated over by scholars. And so he took a lot of heat from other scholars. Now, you know, look, I defend Ruse. What was he supposed to do? Some people have said, intelligent design is not pseudoscience, it's bad science. But that's really not, I think, the correct way to look at it. And again, I think that the scientific attitude helps us to see the difference, right? It's pseudoscience because they're not trying to be open to any evidence that would disprove them. They're convinced to begin with that their ideology is correct. They're just looking for confirming instances, and they're not embracing that critical attitude.
Lee McIntyre, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a philosopher of science based at Boston University, the author of a book called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Your thoughts, comments, questions on how we value science or don't in society right now, welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There's some interesting cases in here about working within the framework of earlier science, you know, essentially building upon the works of earlier scientists, one of the more fascinating cases in the book is about how the existence of Neptune made trouble for Newtonian physicists.
Yeah, there was a perturbation in the orbit of Uranus, which led them to discover Neptune. When you say trouble, though, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. I mean, there were several points before Einstein during which there were, you know, slight difficulties for the Newtonian model. And what happens is, when things like this happen, when you've got a model that's as well ensconced as the Newtonian system, Thomas Kuhn called that an anomaly. And scientists will work on it, and they will not just give up the theory based on one problem, which some people have used as a criticism of Popper's view, right? Because Popper held that, you know, it was just a logical question. If you have one piece of countervening evidence, you give up the theory. Well, that's not actually the way it works in practice. So scientists do live with difficulties sometimes and, you know, try to explain them, put more brain power and more money and more experiments in to test it. When you've got something as difficult as astronomy, it can take a while to overturn the model. The thing that really was an anomaly for the Newtonian model was this little blip in the orbit of Mercury. That was something that the Newtonian model couldn't explain, and Einstein could. And it's because Mercury is so close to the Sun that it was being pulled out of orbit by the gravitational pull of the Sun which again Einstein could explain and Newton couldn't, that ended up being a real mark in Einstein's favor later.
You know, if we back up a little further, we get into the area of received wisdom. So it's not just an issue for scientists, but really for all of us. I mean, how do we know what we know? And so, you know, how, for example, would a scientist know when to take someone else's word for a set of conditions or principles?
Yeah. You know, you asked, you're a philosopher, you asked a great philosophical question there. How do we know when we know? And the thing is, we don't. We don't. We're never certain. And that, I think, is the great strength of science. Some people can look at that as a weakness of science. I think that it's a strength because it means that even a system as beautiful and well ensconced as the Newtonian system can be overthrown by future evidence. Science never closes the books. Science is always looking for that, you know, next piece of data, either to corroborate the theory or to overthrow it. And it means that scientists are just, you know, constantly on the hunt to be sure. Science is not about certainty. Science is about justification given the evidence. And you never have too much. You want as highly warranted a theory as you can possibly have. That, by the way, is what drives me crazy when people say things like Darwinian theory is just a theory. Well, it's so well warranted, it's so well justified that Darwin's theory is really the backbone of molecular biology and microbiology. I mean, you couldn't really explain anything in biology without evolution. That wasn't my statement. I think that was Thomas Dohansky. Who said, you know, that nothing in biology is explicable except in light of evolution?
Well, it just gets us into the places where I mean, it's a theory because science can't prove anything to 100%. I mean,
that's
been proven out many times.
That's right.
But let's talk, for example, about string theory. It seeks to solve what major issue in physics?
Well, string theory is a super controversial area, and I actually have. I had a little bit in the book on this. It's something of a scandal. If you read Brian Greene's book, The Elegant Universe, he talks about this a little bit. Very eloquent science writer at the beginning of his book. So the problem is this: relativity and quantum theory both have evidence in their favor, right? Relativity explains things at the macro level, the largest level, black holes and solar system, and quantum mechanics at the micro level. And they both have evidence in their favor, but they're incompatible with one another. They cannot both be true. And so, I mean, that's, you know, as Green says, that's a scandal. One possible way to reconcile them is string theory. But here's the kicker. String theory does not have any evidence in its favor. String theory is completely a mathematical model that, if it were true, would reconcile those two models, but we have no evidence to show that it's true. Now, the reason why is quite interesting. It's because the experiments are very difficult, if not impossible, at accessible energy levels to perform. And this has led to a real controversy in string theory. Some string theorists claim that this is fine, and they'll perform the experiment someday. And you know, they're talking about the in principle factors. Other string theorists have said that this is not really science. That it's a hoax is too strong of a word, but that it's sort of they've all had too much Kool-Aid and, you know, believe in string theory, even though they don't have the evidence to back it up. Some have even gone so far as to say that it's impossible to test string theory. I'm going to leave that to the physicists to argue about what's possible or impossible at the experimental level. The point I make in the book is simply that there's a difference between saying that it's impossible to test it now and it's impossible to test it ever, and that someday we will have to decide, you know, the fate of string theory will rest on whether or not people grow too uncomfortable with the fact that it doesn't have any evidence in its favor. It's funny, I started out in college in astronomy and physics because I love astronomy and physics, and I then got interested in philosophy, do philosophy science. But I always want to come back someday just to see where they landed, because there are all these super important, very difficult to answer questions, and I'm really fascinated with how the scientists are going to answer them.
Well, and it seems like what you're saying ultimately is that while scientists may disagree vehemently about things like string theory, you see that as a strength of science.
I do. I you know, the scientific dissent. The one thing that's about string theory in particular that's somewhat difficult is this question of whether or not it's a science, because there are some people who claim that we need to redefine what science is so that we can include string theory. So, for instance, if you think that somebody like me who says that science is based on responding to evidence, well, what do you do about string theory that doesn't have any evidence in its favor? Does that mean that it's not a science? Some people have said, okay, so let's redefine science. I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it's a fascinating question.
Much more to talk about with Lee McIntyre. His book is The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. You can join us by phone and email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're having a fascinating discussion about science in the world today and the fact that science is better than it's ever been at proving theories, but also gets greater resistance politically and socially and religiously in our world. Lee McIntyre, who is a philosopher of science at Boston University, offers some ideas in his book, The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions and comments. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So to restate, the scientific attitude is valuing evidence, number one, and number two, being willing to change theories in the face of new evidence. So in 1846 at Vienna General Hospital, as you talk about in the book, how was the scientific attitude demonstrated?
So this is one of my favorite stories, and it's one of the most famous cases in the philosophy of science. So Ignaz Semmelweis was a junior physician at the Vienna Hospital, and what they discovered is that there was this disease at the time. So this was 1846. It's called childbed fever, and it was something that was this deadly infection that some pregnant women would get. And the Vienna Hospital was divided into two wards, so Ward 1 and Ward 2. What they found was that the incidence of childbed fever was 29% in Ward 1, and it was 3% in Ward 2. And nobody really knew why. And Semmelweis was, as I said, a very junior person, but he had a very inquiring mind. And he wanted to try all the different experiments to see. He tried the different position for delivery. He tried the hypothesis of which ward was overcrowded. They used to last rites were delivered by a priest who would walk through ringing a bell, and they used to think that the ringing of the bell might cause people to die of fright. And so it would scare you, right? Coming to give last rites, and so he had the priest come in without ringing the bell. He tried everything, and then he finally figured out that the Ward 1, the children were being delivered by medical students who were coming straight from performing autopsies. So they had cadaveric matter on their hands, whereas in Ward 2 it was midwives. And but now remember, this was about a decade before the germ theory of disease, and so Semmelweis really didn't know anything beyond the fact that the cadaveric matter had something to do with the childbed fever. And so what he did was he asked the medical students to start washing their hands in chlorinated water before they performed the deliveries, and the incidence of childbed fever plummeted. So great demonstration of the scientific attitude. I mean, terrific. But what happened at the time was he was resisted by his colleagues. He was eventually fired, went to several different hospitals in Europe where he demonstrated what he knew, was ultimately committed to an asylum, beaten by the guards, and died of a blood infection that was not dissimilar to childbed fever. So, I mean, talk about a martyr for science. Boy. He had the scientific attitude. The people in the profession at the time did not. And one thing that I do in the book is talk about the fact that fields can undergo a scientific revolution once they embrace the scientific attitude. This, you know, you think to medicine of the 1840s to medicine today, that's a very short period of time. What's the difference? I think the difference is the scientific attitude.
Wow, that is just amazing. That it wasn't just that he got skepticism, but he got out hostility for what he had actually proven to be true.
Yeah, and you think of Giordano Bruno, you think of Galileo, you think of all these martyrs for science in the past. It's incredible the price people have paid for standing up for truth and facts and observation. It's really incredible.
Let's take a call in here. Paul in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lee McIntyre, who wrote The Scientific Attitude.
Good morning. This is a great interview. I would like to bring this home to where we are today. It seems to me that the scientific process and the process of discovery and validation has been utterly corrupted by the political process. Witness the Trump administration pulling the worst case scenario for climate change from its reports, and apparently yoking the scientists to a very, very tame interpretation of the data, looking at all of the issues with big corporate money hiring scientists to prove their point as opposed to going into the fields of discovery, as far as that goes. And finally, looking at where we are on the social sciences as a society and trying to define who we are and where we've been. To me, it seems like the process is corrupted again and again and again by individual interests as opposed to evidence, and is corrupted by political expediency and economic greed. And I'll leave my comments there, and you can take it where you want.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it.
So, yeah, I think you're right, and it's a great question. It's always been the case that there have been ideological and moneyed interests against scientific discovery. If you think back to Galileo's time, it was religious ideology, and the argument I made in Dark Ages is that today it's political ideology doing that to the social sciences. The time I wrote that book in 2006, it wasn't quite ramped up to the point where it is today, but I think I'd make the case today, as you just did, that there are political interests that are interfering with even with natural science. I wrote an earlier book, my book just before Scientific Attitude, is called Post-Truth, where I make the argument that what happened with science denial from the 1950s with the whole tobacco industry's pushback against the link between smoking and lung cancer, you follow that forward for 70 years, and that was a blueprint for post-truth. I think that people discovered that if you can deny the truth about smoking and lung cancer, if you can deny the truth about climate change, about vaccines, you can deny the truth about whether it's raining during an inauguration or how many people were at that inauguration or anything else that you want to that you want to deny. It's not to make the claim that all science denial is partisan, because it's not. If you look at anti-vax, it tends to be bipartisan. Climate change is probably more partisan from the right, but I think it's always been the case that people have their own personal, ideological, financial interests. When those conflict with science, there can be tremendous pushback.
Denialists are not really skeptics, you write. So what are they? I mean, other than denialists.
Well, it's an interesting question, because I think that deniers like to paint themselves as skeptics. because that just sounds so fair-minded. But if you think of what skepticism really means, I mean, a skeptic is somebody who's withholding belief until enough evidence comes in to have the rational basis to make up their mind. Making the claim that we don't have enough evidence yet for anthropogenic climate change, that's faux skepticism. I mean, it just came out in Reuters the other day that it's at the five sigma level now. It's a million to one shot that the climate deniers are correct. That's not a rational basis for forming a belief. The argument that I make in the book is that I think that one important strain in science denial, no matter what kind of science denial, is belief in conspiracy theories at some level. And, you know, if you look at that, conspiracy theorists are not skeptics. They're cafeteria skeptics, right? They're skeptical about the things that they don't want to believe, but they're completely gullible about the things that they do want to believe. That's not true skepticism. Scientists are the true skeptics.
Let us take another call. This is Grumpy John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
What do you do when you have absolute evidence and not a clue as to what's going on? I am talking about some of the megaliths in Peru and in Egypt. We have pieces of stone that are quarried that we do not have any explanation for how they could have been moved 100 miles from where they were quarried. We have no explanation for how they were moved at all, because nothing that we could do today could move some of the rocks that they have cut out and obviously intended to move.
Okay, thanks for that question. So we got that, Stonehenge, Newgrange in Ireland, yeah. A couple of places here.
Well, I'm not quite familiar with the case that you bring up, but I will say this: it's important to look at where the evidence comes from, right? When you're looking at quote unquote scientific evidence, is it coming from from actual peer-reviewed, you know, double-blind controlled studies? If it's in medicine, is it coming from people who are trying to gather objective evidence? Or is it coming from somewhere else? So that's important. But if what you're saying is actually a fact, then it's a ripe area for scientific investigation. Reminds me of a story that I talked about in the book of Harlan Bretz, who was a geologist in Western Washington State about 70 or 80 years ago. And he was studying the fact that there were all of these physical anomalies in what he called the scablands in Washington that could not be explained by the existing geography. You had pebbles up on top of the very high bluffs, and you had these huge spillways that only had a little bit of water coming out of them. And it gave all this evidence for a giant flood, which everybody thought at the time couldn't possibly be right. But he stayed at it, and he found what the explanation was. So if what the caller's saying is true, that there really is no other explanation, then it's an anomaly that demands an explanation. You need to go after it. I have to say, though, here I'm slightly skeptical, because I have heard similar cases where it turned out that there are actually explanations for what was a seeming anomaly.
We had talked earlier about the scientists coming out on Earth Day 2017 on the March for Science, extremely mad scientists, stuff
right.
like that.
So
and you agreed that they do need to be a little more vocal anyway to defend themselves. Do they have to be more concerned about their own failings too, though?
I think so, but I think that's one thing that you can count on scientists to do. That is, as a profession, you look at the replication crisis. Look at the problem with something I discussed in the book, p-hacking, which is this statistical method that some scientists have used to try to find correlations where maybe there's no causation, but they can get the paper published. And what happens is that once scientists become aware of problems like this, they figure out a way to combat it. Scientists, as I said, are these congenital skeptics who are used to solving problems and figuring out things like that. It's not to say that there are no problems in science. it's not to say that there isn't fraud. I think that fraud is the ultimate betrayal of the scientific attitude, because these are people who swear to uphold the norms of science and then break them. The really brilliant thing about science is that even when something like that happens, through community scrutiny, through many different minds thinking about the same problem, it brings it back. It can take an incredibly long time to gather enough evidence to do that. So that's why fraud is not really tolerated, because it's such a betrayal. But it can make the profession will, I don't know if I want to go so far as to say that it's self-correcting, but it definitely is one of the areas of human conduct where, if we're going to find the answer, we're going to find it through science.
And before we go, we only have about a minute left. You did touch on the social sciences a couple times briefly, but do you see a pathway for the social sciences to get accepted into the club with the hard scientists? Are the rules of evidence commensurate? Can they be pulled together?
Yeah, this is my dream for the social sciences, that they become more scientific. And in the book, I make the case that they can follow the exact path that medicine did. If you look at medicine in 1840, it's kind of exactly the same position the social sciences are in now. People are deciding things based on folk wisdom and instinct. It's not a good scientific procedure, and I think that there is good social science, and I point that out in the book. There's also some bad social science too, and I also point that out in the book. But I think they can make it. What they need to do is embrace the scientific attitude.
And the attitude, again, value evidence and change when you're presented with evidence that proves the stuff that you thought was true and untrue. The book is called The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. It's the work of Lee McIntyre at Boston University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.